I'm speaking today with Anthony Troiani, who is running for Congress in the 34th District. Mr. Troiani, thank you for speaking with me today. Why are you running for this office?
Charles, thank you for interviewing me. I'm running for this office because I'd like to bring some accountability and a strong voice for South Texas.
Okay. You are a city commissioner, or have been a city commissioner for Brownsville. What is that, like a city council position?
Correct. I was a city commissioner in Brownsville from 2007 to 2011.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what you did while you were a city commissioner?
As a city commissioner, it's basically like a city council position. I was the at-large city commissioner and covered the entire city of Brownsville. And while I was with the city commission, we had several different projects, obviously economic development, quality of life issues. We also worked on a lot of federal issues. Brownsville is very unique in that it has location on the river by the sea, and we have a lot of federal issues. We have immigration issues. We have the border wall issue was one of the issues that came up as well. And then we also have some customs issues, and there's a lot of concern with economic development here. We were designated one of the poorest communities in the United States. We have a need for economic development and education.
Okay. What experience did you have, like, well, interacting with Congress or your congressperson while a member of the city council in Brownsville?
When I was with the city council, we had gone up several times to Washington and met with our congressman. One of the big issues was the border wall. We had a lot of pushback from DHS and other governmental entities at the time to place the border wall. And it's really kind of comical because they put the border wall through Hope Park. And Hope Park is the start of the Chisholm Trail, and it is also one of the places where we had basically it's a park dedicated to renewal and by national goodwill, and that was where DHS decided to put the border wall through. We would go up to Washington and talk to Saul Ortiz's office and his staff, and we tried to get them to agree to hold off on putting the border wall up. But in the end, what happened is we were able to negotiate a reversionary clause in the border wall. And so essentially Brownsville is the only community between Port Isabel and San Diego to have the capacity to remove the border wall. And that would include a levee reinforcement and a subgrade facing on the levee in downtown Brownsville. And then after those two issues are completed, then the city could then have the wall removed, and we actually have a few projects that we were looking at putting in. And one of the big reasons that we were able to get that clause put in place was because of the economic need, and then also the issues with safety regarding FEMA and flood control.
Okay. So, you know, since we've done all this talk about the border wall, which fortunately, as far as I know, is not going forward at this time, you know, Brownsville being down there on the border like that, what does comprehensive immigration reform look like to you? What does that look like, and what does border security look like to you? What do those terms mean to you?
Well, when we were with when I was with the city commission, we spoke with Patton Boggs, and we spoke with some other lobbying companies, and border security starts with border prosperity. Mexico and the southern part of the United States are, especially in our area, Matamoros and Brownsville, are joined at the hip. We are a regional force, and how goes their economy affects us as well. So one of the things that we talked about doing was trans-border economic development zones. And one of the big things that Patton Boggs did was it was involved in some of the country building in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And they were talking about trying to bring these development zones, not just corridors for transport, but in entire zones into place across the border. We have a unique situation in that, you know, Brownsville has about 175, maybe 220,000 residents, both documented and undocumented. But across the river, we have probably 3.2 million people. And, you know, if you include Monterrey in there and you start talking about Reynosa and everything, the entire lower Rio Grande Valley and the Monterrey area, you're probably talking about 7 million people. It's a large metropolitan area, and it forms a cluster. So when you talk about economic development, you talk about immigration issues and binational economic development, it's very important that we're able to work with northern Mexico, northern Leon, and also Tamaulipas.
Okay. So what steps would you do you want to see taken on, you know, immigration reform?
Well, what I would like to see on immigration reform is we need to be in a situation where people who are educated in our country are allowed to stay in our country to continue their education. One of the things about the DREAM Act was the access to college, but I think it's important that you're not only allowed to access college, but that you become a citizen. When I served in the Marine Corps, we had people who were from Nicaragua and El Salvador and Mexico who had come in as legal residents and were serving, but they still didn't have their citizenship. And, you know, it's a volunteer force right now. I think if people are willing to serve our country, then they should become citizens of our country. Just like students who have grown up here and have been educated in our schools, they need an opportunity to become citizens in our country because, you know, the United States has always been a place where people have risked everything to come to. It's been a land of opportunity. My grandparents immigrated here, and, you know, we need people who are willing to take that risk, are willing to invest in our country with their lives and with their families and their livelihood. When we lose that, then we lose a lot of the esteem that we had built up over the decades around the world.
Okay. You've talked a lot about economic development. What sorts of policies or legislation would you pursue as a member of Congress to, you know, enhance economic development, not just for Brownsville, but for, you know, the rest of Texas and everywhere else?
Well, some of the things that are being talked about are the National Infrastructure Bank, a National Infrastructure Committee or Commission, where we would tag programs for needs-based criteria. You know, there's been a lot of talk about trying to get rid of some of the, for lack of a better word, pork barrel, you know, politicking, et cetera, and trying to make it a more holistic approach. I think if you start looking at needs and you look at, you know, regional needs, then communities like, you know, Brownsville, McAllen, Raymondville are going to be high on the criteria list. Willacy County, which is the county directly to the north of Cameron County, is considered the poorest community or the poorest county in the United States. It also has the largest economic divide between the upper class and the bottom. And we need to bridge those gaps. Some of the big things that would do that, the STEM program, where you're doing science, technology, math, and engineering programs that can be directly targeted to some of the schools. We had a recent situation where Bass Pro Shop came into Harlingen, Texas, and there were 3,000 applicants for 300 jobs. Texas Workforce came in and said that they were only able to fill 150 of those jobs initially because they were concerned about the quality of the workforce. Those are basic entry-level positions on the most part, and so we need to make sure that our schools are prepared to educate our population. There's only two types of resources. That's natural resources and human resources. We have a wealth of, human resources in this area, and as you go up the district, we have more natural resources, and we need to make sure that we're investing in our human resources so that we're able to move forward. That's going to be a big issue in the coming years.
You know, when you talk about the economy these days, you also kind of have to talk about not just policies to, you know, improve business and education and whatnot. You also have to talk about the tax code and, you know, unfairness or imbalances that exist within it. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, the tax code has been an issue for a long, long time. It's one of those, and you know, you start looking at the economy and you start talking about issues. When the first income tax was put in place, it was, you know, essentially to pay for the Civil War. Okay, Lincoln imposed that, Republican. We had Bush come along, and he decided that, you know, it would be okay to cut taxes and divert funds and fight two wars. You know, it's kind of hard to say that we don't have a problem with our economy after that kind of activity. And I think that, you know, there needs to be restructuring. Obviously, when you've got situations where people are paying, you know, secretaries are paying, you know, less than they are for income, that, you know, there needs to be some redistribution. At the same time, you need to make sure that it's not lopsided. And I don't mind paying my fair share, and I don't think that anybody else who's, you know, involved in the system would feel otherwise. You have to invest in your country, and you have to make sure that you're, you know, supporting it, not just, you know, with, you know, verbally, but, you know, also with actual actions. And that's why I agree that we need to redistribute, but, you know, I also think that it has to be done comprehensively.
Okay. Your district is in a part of the state that was hit pretty hard by last year's drought, and unlike some other parts of the state, is still being pretty hard affected by it. Do you think that situation needs a federal response?
Well, you know, historically, we go through drought cycles. We, you know, don't have a large, you know, we have irregular rainfall, and that's a fact. If you're talking about water consumption on a large level, yesterday I took a tour of proposed wind farm sites in South Texas, and they were going to be actually based about 8.5 to 9 miles off the coast. And this was the Baryonyx fields. They have two permits they're trying to get. One of the applications that they were talking about with the wind farm was actually to drive a desal plant. And that would be something that, you know, desal plants are generally very high electricity users. And it's something that, you know, we've been looking at. What they were talking about was each of the turbines was going to provide about 6 kilowatts. They were looking at a field of about 300. So you're looking over a little bit more than 1,000 megawatts overall. And if you could hook that up to a desal plant, that'd be something that would, you know, potentially be a great benefit to the area. We're just in the permitting phase and discussing whether or not it's viable based on migratory bird flows and costs. But one of the things that struck me was that they were saying that the turbines would be solely wind generated. They would not have natural gas or other sources of power. So that was kind of something that I thought was you know, beneficial, because then they could totally rely on wind. And that would be something, depending on the size of the desal plant, that could provide, you know, fresh water. That's kind of cutting edge technology. In general, you know, water is a huge issue, and water access and drainage are, you know, federal issues. One of the, we were talking to IPWC and FEMA along the river with trying to make sure that we've got the levee construction necessary for protection, and making sure that we can ensure new growth and properties along the Rio Grande. And there's just a whole section of issues. We could talk about water all afternoon.
Okay. Healthcare, I mean.
Healthcare is an ongoing problem in South Texas and across the country. The biggest problem is that, you know, our population mix is not the same mix that you have in Massachusetts, or it's the same mix that you have in California. We have a large indigent population. Getting services to this population is, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, a luxury. It's a necessity, because it's going to drive the cost. One of the big things that we did in Brownsville was start the Biggest Loser program, which was to bring awareness to the risk. outreach to the average consumer. We coupled with UT Health Science Center out of Houston, and it's been a program that's gotten a lot of good press, but it's an educational program, because healthcare costs are, you have to look at how much you're going to save for preventive costs, the cost of insurance. You've got to look at also at doctors and making sure that they're being that you bring quality physicians into the area, and we've got some quality physicians, and they need to be maintained and kept here. And we get about 70 to 75% of the clinical visits are probably in Medicare, Medicaid. Maybe 15% are actually health insurance coverage, and then you've got a gap of another 10% or 15% that are just completely uninsured. That's a completely different mix. And when you start talking about the new healthcare proposals, that's a completely different mix than you would get in, Los Angeles, or you'd get in Boston, where you've got a more qualified or educated workforce that's making a higher salary, and you've got more insurance coverage. It's a big deal. It's very scary to a lot of people, because they're concerned about whether or not they're going to continue to get coverage, whether or not they're going to be opted out, what's going to happen with their own coverages. And doctors are concerned about, being able to operate. A lot of the smaller pharmacists are very concerned about keeping their doors open and being able to compete with the bigger, more national pharmacies. And I think as a congressman, it's very important that we not only look for national solutions, but we look at what's going to affect our region. And there's a lot of local small shops that need to be kept open, because they do provide an integral service.
Now, there's been recent controversy over providing birth control in insurance plans, in particular the compromise that the Obama administration came to, or I should say the decision they came to regarding requiring insurance providers, have birth control coverage for women in employee provided plans for religious institutions. What was your impression of the Obama administration's compromise plan on that?
Well, I'm Catholic, and I believe in a separation of church and state. And I understand the intent behind it and wanting to provide comprehensive health services. I think that when you start going into a religious entity, that becomes a little difficult. I do believe that there should be a separation. And I don't think it's necessarily, if you're going to provide comprehensive health care, then the recipient and the insurer should be in the conversations about what's going to be done. I don't think that when you put the employer in a position of having to make moral decisions about what an employee can receive or use, I think you really kind of lose your objectivity. And that's just, I would never tell one of my employees what to do, no matter what my my personal views may be. I wouldn't tell them how to treat their bodies. You have some inalienable rights, and I just think you're kind of stepping over the lines there. And I don't think it's necessarily government's role to tell people what they can and can't do with their bodies.
Okay. The District 34. It's a new number, but it's in many ways the old 27th District.
I like to say is that, and not to cut you off, I like to say it's the southern half of Ortiz's district and the northern half of Mr. Hinojosa's district.
Okay.
They've kind of shoved those two together and made something new.
All right. Well, these districts were the result. I mean, obviously, the whole redistricting battle, and there's litigation still going on. The districts that we have now were the result of an agreement between a couple of the plaintiffs in the redistricting lawsuit, particularly the Texas Latino Redistricting Task Force and the Attorney General's office. What's your view of the compromise, or I should say the interim map that is in place for 2012, And what changes, if any, would you like to see made to this district as the litigation proceeds to a conclusion?
You know, I really don't see a whole lot of difference between what was proposed by the Republican legislature and what's been, you know, finalized for this year. You know, my big concern is that Deep South Texas have a voice that it hasn't had in a long, long time. But, you know, when you start looking at the way the district has been cobbled together, I think that you've got some really good components. One of the things that we lack down here in Cameron County is the natural gas and oil production capabilities that you're seeing up in the, you know, Alice and B counties and some of those other parts of the district. And so I think the way it's been put together now, it could be a very dynamic district. You have some components that, you know, I like the way it's kind of come together. I don't know that I would necessarily want it to change. I've met a lot of people in my campaign up in B and Quetzal and, you know, Goliad and over here in Gonzales counties and in Kingsville and Cleburne. And you start talking about some of the issues that they have, and I don't think they're necessarily, you know, opposed. I think that if you, the congressman is willing to get in there and work on those issues, you can serve the whole region. It's going to be a big area to cover. But, you know, personally, my family comes from a farming and ranching background. I'm not in that on a daily basis. I've gone through a different path. I went to law school after the Marine Corps, and you know, I've lived in Houston and been down here. I've been practicing down in Brownsville now for the last 15 years. So for me, it's been a lot of fun to get back and, you know, talking and looking forward to working with some people who have a background that's very similar to that of my parents and what I grew up doing. So I actually like the way the district came out, and I like the way it looks. And I also, you know, we don't have a whole lot of, you know, oil and gas in Cameron County, and getting involved with some of those people and talking about the Eagle Ford Shale issues, the possibility of, you know, actually becoming energy independent along with the alternatives, wind sources, like going out here off the coast yesterday and seeing that, it's, you know, it's very exciting. And it's, you know, the whole idea that we've exported jobs over the last, you know, 20 years, and we've exported our manufacturing base, and the potential of bringing that back, where we are an energy exporter, where we are providing a comprehensive energy plan, is, you know, very, very exciting. As a city commissioner, we tried to get light industry to come down into Brownsville, and we talked to people about energy generation, and we have the Public Utilities Board has its own power plant, and we have about 30 megawatts that we put out, 35 megawatts, and we were really kind of needing 112 to 115 to bring more capacity with the cables coming down here, with the possibility of having the over 1,000 megawatts being produced offshore, and then with the natural gas and possible natural gas liquefaction facilities at the port. You know, this area could be booming, and it would be integrated. And really, you know, we send a lot of scrap metal into Monterrey, and there is a lot of potential to expand. And, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily want to change the district.
Okay. If you win the nomination for this district and President Obama calls you up and says, Anthony, I'd like to come down and do a, you know, campaign for you, what would you say to him, and what would you like for him to talk about in your district?
You know, I think that, well, one, I'd say thank you first. And if he were to come down and down to my district, what I'd like him to talk about is just what we talked about just a second ago. And that's trying to revitalize some of this area through the
And, you know, there are, I believe, 11 candidates running for the nomination for this congressional seat.
There are eight Democrats, and there are, I believe, three Republicans.
Okay. Well, when people go to vote in May to pick the Democratic nominee for Congressional District 34, why should they vote for you and not one of your opponents?
Well, I think if you just listen to me for the last few minutes, you'll understand that I've taken a good look at these issues. I'm someone who has worked in the community. I'm from the community, and I understand what our needs are. I am someone who has worked his way up. My parents are not wealthy people by any means. We have worked for what we had. I went to public school down here in Brownsville, Texas. I joined the Marine Corps, went off to college, paid for the college with the GI Bill, and I worked in the summers up in Chicago loading trucks as a Teamster. Graduated from college and went off to law school and came back home. I got a lot of pushback from friends of mine who were from South Texas who are now living up in Houston and San Antonio and Austin areas. And I was like, you know what? It's a good place to live. It's a good place to raise a family. And it's home. And I came back for the right reasons. And I think that shows. And people who've seen me in the city commission know that, I'm willing to work hard and I intend to work hard when I'm elected as the congressman for District 34.
Okay. Anthony Troiani, thank you very much for speaking with me today.